Well, if you're clear on that, on the setting of the problem, is that all right? I want now to come back from the New Testament. I want to look at things philosophically for a while, just analyse thoughts about it, to try and get our mind and its search for meaning in some position, and then, from there, go back to the New Testament and relook at a lot of our texts and try to see them hopefully in a new light. I'm going to begin from some assumptions, of course, because I can't take us right back to bedrock every time, though we're close to it tonight. I want to start in my argument from the assumption that there is one God, that that God is love, and that the love is all-powerful. I want to start from that position and see if it can stay there when we analyse it. I want to start from the text of Scripture, which we looked at earlier, but look at it again now, how God saw all that he made, and indeed it was very good. God made everything, and it was good. And now we've got to ask this key question. In that case, where does evil come from? How do we find any meaning in it? Thirdly, I want to alert you to an obvious fact that the world of which we are part is a world in process. That's the fact. It's a world that does not hold its being altogether, but it time is part of it, a process of being, a development, all that you know, an evolutionary process is going on. You start as a baby and you grow through and mature and then into age and so on, and the whole world is on the move. So we're in a world, and granted that's the fact, it's in process, and part of that process is human freedom. And here we've got the nearest I can take you to the key. Human freedom, that marvellous quality that, like, who'd be without it? I mean, if you weren't free, love would be pointless. It wouldn't exist. Joy, sense of humour, compassion. Only freedom makes those possible. If you had to love me, a big deal. I mean, the attraction of your love is that you don't have to, but you do. And that's a surprise and a joy and a marvellous thing. A man, the good Samaritan, didn't have to stop, and that was the beauty of it, but he chose to stop. So, obviously, none of us would want to be without freedom. And a second point about freedom is, I don't want to say that freedom necessarily requires the ability to do evil things. That can't be right. Freedom in its fullness would surely be, would make you such that you couldn't choose evil, because your freedom would be recognition of good in all its beauty, and the more free you become, the less you're able to do evil, the less you're able to make foolish choices and so on. I think that's true. The freedom of what we see as heaven is not a freedom or an ability to make choices. In that sense, it's a affirming of a choice already made, such that, can you imagine Mother Teresa murdering somebody? Do you think it's possible? I mean, I don't know her, but I'm just saying that it sounds really unlikely, because the compassion has brought her to a stage where it's just impossible. Can you imagine my mother rejecting me? I honestly, she wouldn't, couldn't. She can't, thank God. We've got plenty of reason to, but she really can't. Can you imagine Jerry's mother rejecting him? Impossible to imagine. Why? Because a person has come through free choices to a beautiful state where the light is too overwhelming to be denied. But my experience, whatever it might be when I die, at the moment I'm not there and you're not there, and the fact is that freedom is not a gift. We're not born. Who said that stupid song, Born Free? It's the one thing we're not born. We're born with capacities to do things. But freedom is the achievement of life. freedom is the goal. We become gradually, please God, more or less free. And if you have any freedom, then I thank your parents and your teachers and you, because it's a magnificent achievement of human choice. However, if we make a world, if God made a world in process, and if, for reasons I can't even begin to enter, part of that process was a development of freedom too, where freedom is in process, where you're not born a saint, but there's some beauty apparently about becoming a saint, where you're not born a lover, you're born a selfish little thing, but you grow to become a lover. Well, if that's the case, then in the freedom that I experience, the limited, broken, hesitant freedom that you and I have at different levels, that does involve a capacity to say no. And the heroism of the yes is in one way in proportion to the ability to say no. And so, when we look at evil then, and by evil I mean something very clear for the moment, I mean moral evil, there is no other evil. I mean evil, not suffering. Suffering is a consequence, but I'm talking about evil. Evil is when I am able to say yes and I choose to say no. And could you listen to me again carefully, because I mean that very carefully. If I'm unable to say yes to love because of the limits of my environment, my heredity, my condition, if I'm unable to say yes and I say no, that's not evil. No evil is being done. I'm just where I am. I'm not adding any darkness. I'm in the dark, but I'm not adding to the dark. Evil, moral evil, sin we call it, moral evil is when I could have said yes, however little tiny it might be, a tiny bit of freedom. Well, our freedom's terribly limited, isn't it? And if you've got none, then, well, none of you have none. That little gap, that little possibility of movement towards good, that little tiny thing that I could have done, minimal as it is and missed as it might be by many, if I could have, but I chose to turn my back on it and say no to it, that's evil. That adds to the dark. That obscures the light. And that's the terrible thing I'm talking about. I think one must say about it, this is my final statement, and I feel very confident of this, it is irrational. You cannot find understanding of evil. It is absurd. It's precisely irrational. And finding meaning means finding reasons in it. There are no reasons to be found. It's a hard fact, and I think it cannot admit of intelligent understanding. That's a big thing to say, but I think that's the only ultimate rock that can't be opened. Why I say no when I could say yes is a total mystery. I know why I say, I can think of many reasons why I say no, because of the limitations of my freedom, eh? Well, you know that too, because of parental income and all that. But when I could have said yes and I say no, when I turn back on love, when I could have accepted it, God help us, no reasons for that. The cause of it, where do I look for the cause of this absurd thing that I can't find reasons for? Well, the great philosophers of our world say, and I can't pretend to see any more than they, so I'll just share it with you. They say, you don't look to God for it. The cause is not in God, it's in the abuse of human freedom. That's not an explanation, it's just going back on itself. It's saying, the reason why you say no has something to do with your abuse of that beautiful gift of freedom. That's the end of my intelligent understanding of it. Just to show you Thomas Aquinas saying it, it may give you some encouragement, because if you can do better, please do so. I haven't found anyone doing it. The first cause of the lack of grace lies in us. The first cause is not in God, it's in us. This statement I won't dare try and interpret for you. I shall read it, though, from the Book of the Sentences. Although God is the creative cause of our will, that is, the one who calls us up out of nothing, this will, human will, has its being from nothing, from no other than itself. And precisely for that reason, the defects of the will which follow from a creaturely deficiency may not be carried back to a further or higher cause. I won't elucidate it for you. I'm not sure I could without going too deeply, and I don't know that I can go much more deeply than I am. I'm putting it there almost as a simple authoritative statement to assure you that at least what I'm suggesting to you is not dreamed up from my own thoughts. Whether St. Thomas was right in saying it is a good question, but he did say it, and he's not to be scoffed at too readily. So he is saying the cause of the abuse of human freedom does not come from God. Moral evil is not caused by God. It's caused by the creature, strange, mysterious as that may be. In fact, surely this is the insight, the native simple insight of the book of Genesis. I mean, without great philosophical penetration, that poetry and mythology of the book of Genesis talks about the creation of the world. It's all very beautiful. And then it comes to the fall of man and woman. And it wasn't God that did it. It was man's desire to reach up and snatch at power and to become him, you know, to reach for the fruit of the tree of good and evil. Instead of waiting for the fruit to drop, instead of waiting on the processes of God's love, who wanted us to be like him, we want to be like God on our own. That's the image, and it's poetry, trying to reach for something. And the fault is put clearly at man and in that primitive mythology. And so here comes the bottom line in all this. The evil, if the cause of it is in the abuse of our gift of freedom, not yet fully attained freedom, but freedom in process, then evil is against the will of God. That sounds so simple, I just want to put it in real evil. Obvious point. You knew it before you came here tonight. But look at the consequences of it in a minute. Evil is against God's will, not in accordance with God's will. When we say, therefore, that the crucifixion, which is surely an evil, it's a decision made by the magistrates of the day, whatever, against God's will. It's a sinful decision. It's a decision made out of petty pride and jealousy and political advantage and all that the crucifixion is as a historical event, the murdering of an innocent man. Totally evil, morally evil, within limits, you know, darkness and all that. But clearly can't be seen to be good. As such, the crucifixion has to be said to be against God's will. I think it's as simple as that. That's the first thing to say about it, surely. So when Paul says, as we've seen now, when he talks about being in accordance with God's will, what's he saying? There seems to be a bit of a contradiction, I think you'll grant. So what could he mean? And now let me make some suggestions to you. Some say, oh, well, it means that God didn't will it, but he permitted it. And there's a catch-22 in there that I don't like. Maybe there's something I can't see, but I've looked at that very hard and I don't like it. It smells bad to me. Because if God permitted it, what does that mean? See, that permitting can mean two things. If permit can mean, like you, a mother or father, allow, you don't want your children to do something, but you allow it. Allow usually means that you could have stopped them, but you chose not to, doesn't it? And if God could have stopped the crucifixion but didn't, the problem's right back at God's step again. Well, why didn't he? You know, it doesn't get him off the hook at all. You say, well, why didn't you? He could have stopped the Vietnam War. He could have stopped the terrors of our world or whatever, the nuclear holocaust. Well, if he doesn't, well, that's pretty bad, I would have thought. That can't be the meaning of it. I think it has meaning only if you understand it, meaning this, that God, in creating a world in process, in creating freedom in process, obviously created the possibility of the consequences of freedom in process. Because if I am able to say yes to your love, in fact, in the early stages of my freedom, that means I can say no. And that is in some way the beauty of the yes, isn't it? That I could have said no. But if I say no, If I say no, then it's because I am this kind of person. The only way to avoid that would be to create us all in a state, in the angelic state, and even they didn't do too well, apparently, according to the story, but to create us at the full perfection of who we are, and that gets rid of babies, adolescents, teenage kids, and everybody in this room. So if you want to vanish, good luck to you. But it would do without all that. Or to make us all machines, automatons. I won't say computers because they're whatever they are. But, you know, it would be nothing. We'd lose all that gives any of us any joy. So God, in choosing to make an imperfect coming to perfection world, allowed for the possibility. But nothing in God wants it, and everything in God's creative power is working against it. But still it's possible for a high priest, idolatrously and blasphemously, to crucify Jesus in God's name. It's possible. It happens. Therefore, I think a lovely way of capturing the meaning of this accordance with God's will is to say that it's within the providence of God. I think that's what the New Testament is saying. But not even something as terrible as the crucifixion is outside the providence of God. God isn't a victim of our evil. Even when we do evil, God doesn't just stand back and do nothing. God isn't irrelevant to it. God is at the heart of that life process. And even felix culpa of Adam, even evil can bring good. Even the crucifixion can be redemptive. Even something as terrible as the murder of Jesus can release an enormous amount of love. Not because of the fact that he was killed, but because of the way he accepted it and freely made of it an act of love. And that's what astonishes us. Thanks be to the grace of the God in whom Jesus believed. Finally, in accordance with God's will, we believe, the resurrection shows, that God not only is not irrelevant to evil, not only is present loving, consoling, strengthening, but God ultimately overcomes evil. That evil, the light, the darkness cannot put out the light. That the resurrection of Jesus overcame the crucifixion. This is the theology of the early church, and I probably don't need to prove it to you, but it's not bad to look at those texts just as a mass of texts before you. They're from the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, and chapter 5. They're not selected. They are the first four sermons of Peter in the Acts of the Apostles, representing an early strand of theology, and that's all that's there. I haven't left anything out, and look at them. All of them perfectly clear on the way the early church understood the crucifixion. This man, says Peter, you took and crucified, had crucified by men outside the law. You killed him. God raised him to life. I didn't say God killed him. You killed him. God raised him to life. The God of our ancestors has glorified his servant Jesus, the same Jesus, says Peter again, that you handed over and then disowned in the presence of Pilate after Pilate had decided to release him. It was you who accused the Holy One, the Just One. It was you who demanded the reprieve of a murderer while you killed the Prince of Life. Heavy stuff. Unreal. That's what happened. Sinfully. Against God's will all that happened. God, however, raised him from the dead. Jesus of Nazareth, the one you crucified, whom God raised from the dead. There it is again. And lastly, it was the God of our ancestors who raised up Jesus. It was you who had him executed by hanging on a tree. Are you clear with me still up to there? We can come back on some of this, I promise. It's enormous stuff. I want you to hold just where we've reached in our argument, and I'm going to come in at another tangent and try and hold it together. So far, I've tried to establish for you that Jesus' own attitude to his death never blamed God. I've tried to look philosophically at it, and that is the best I can do, to say that one can't automatically say, you must say, whatever God wills happens. If God is almighty, then logically that you must say that whatever God wills happens. Let there be light, and light was. Eh? Nothing can stop will, God's will happening. But you cannot make the other reverse logical statement. Whatever happens is God's will. You can't make that statement, because evil happens, and it doesn't happen because God wills it. It happens because we human beings abuse our freedom. A mystery, a conundrum, a block that we can't penetrate. But that's where philosophy and the scriptural theology and places the blame for it. So to argue from something happening to the fact that it must be God's will seems at first glance to make sense. It's not doesn't make sense when one analyzes it, I think.